we simultaneously denuded the soils of the earth and the soils within the guts of humanity. And for that, we see a decrease in our vitality.
On this week's podcast, I am honored to have had the conversation with Zach Bush. He's a triple board certified medical doctor. He went to school at the University of Virginia. That's where I grew up. I went to college at William & Mary, so we have similarities in terms of where different parts of our lives have overlapped. In addition to his clinic, he spends the majority of his time now doing educational stuff. He started a new nonprofit called Farmer's Footprint. You can check it out online. We talk about it in the podcast. He's a huge advocate for regenerative agriculture. And we talk a lot about glyphosate, how to protect yourself from it, where it is, the pervasiveness of it in this podcast. This is not meant to be doom and gloom. This is meant to be awareness. Knowledge is power. Know better, do better. In this podcast, we definitely give actionable tips and tools that you can use to minimize your exposure to glyphosate and also move forward to live a healthier life. This podcast is also a little more spiritual than my usual podcast, but I loved having these conversations with Zach. Living in Costa Rica, I really, really appreciate connection with nature, and this isn't something I always get the chance to talk about. So I'm really happy that we got to kind of get into the sort of flow in the natural world and connection with nature. So this one's a little different than the usual podcast, but I think you guys really find value in this. And again, I'm grateful to Zach for coming on and spending time with me. All right, guys, check out this podcast. Enjoy. Zach Bush, thanks for coming on the podcast, man. It's been a long time coming. I'm excited to talk to you.
Paul, it's thrilling to be with you. Really glad to be with your audience as well.
Yeah, man, I heard you say on another podcast a statistic that I thought was mind-blowing, that there's like a 2007 study in Mississippi, and they found glyphosate in 75% of air and rainwater samples.
Yeah.
like, okay, what is glyphosate? How did we get here? And why is this a big deal?
Amazing. It is an extraordinary statistic, and it's a demonstration of just a little bit of the short-sightedness of human industry and human behavior in our efforts towards an economic environment and social environment, economic environment of scaling profits and scaling economies, a social phenomenon of convenience. And so I think it's important to just frame that, because there's a tendency in this space of, you know, understanding environmental impact and toxicity of human behavior to blame companies or blame individuals or blame governments or whatever it is. And there's an opportunity for us to look much deeper than that injury and start to understand that this is actually an expression of humanity and our current relationship or failure of relationship to nature. So that's kind of the framework of understanding what is glyphosate. Glyphosate is a chemical that is in a family called the organophosphates. And the organophosphates were first commercially developed as chemical warfare. The first major success there was from a company named Monsanto that developed a compound called Agent Orange, which for 25 years was dumped into the rainforest and some of the most verdant ecosystems of the planet to destroy Cambodia and much of North Vietnam, to expose the Ho Chi Minh Trail so that the U.S. military and others were able to kill adversaries more effectively that had been hiding under the canopy of rainforests. And so this family of molecules was extraordinarily effective at destroying greenery. And we could take entire jungles into moonscapes in just a few weeks. And if you Google, you know, Cambodia or North Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh Trail, you know, maybe you need to add Agent Orange in there. It literally looks like the images you've seen of the moon. Gray dust for as far as you can see, not a single, not only green thing, there's no other color than gray. It looks like a nuclear bomb went off. And wow. So trees are flattened, you know, the whole region just turned into a moonscape. And so that chemical kind of warfare mentality of we can kill green was an effort towards, you know, our first kind of full-on combat with nature, you know, played out at the large scale of humanity there. And after that 25-year journey, we had witnessed a lot of cancer and skin problems and you know, pulmonary issues, immune system deficiencies in people that had been exposed to the Agent Orange. And you'll maybe remember, if you're old enough, that Vietnam vets had a huge morbidity and mortality from their exposure to these chemicals. So they came home in 1973, Monsanto then out of a job with one of their main chemical productions, very small company at the time, not some big behemoth, started working on new applications for organophosphates, and they found their way into utilizing this family of compounds to clean municipal pipes instead of kill things. And so they found that it's a potent chelator. It pulls minerals out of the environment. And so rather than just killing green things, they realized they could clean pipes that had large amounts of sediment in it. So they start pouring amazing amounts of this through manufacturing plants, mining systems, and stuff like this to clean this. And what they found was it was super effective at cleaning out pipes that had, you know, decades or sometimes hundreds of years of sediment in it. They could chelate the minerals off of there, locking those minerals away from the biologic environment. Unfortunately, when the pipe then emptied into a pond or whatnot, it wiped out all the fish and biology. And so they, in their trials for this, realized they can't take this to market as a pipe cleaner because it took too high of a concentration. So they went back to the drawing board. And in 1974, they purchased a patent from a Japanese inventor who had patented another organophosphate chemical in 1959, and it never brought it to market. They purchased that, and then by 1976, launched that as a weed killer, recognizing that perhaps was slightly less toxic than the Agent Orange, was their hope. Launched that in 1976 to replace some very toxic chemicals that we were currently using in the United States and around the world to kill weeds in agricultural environments. And those were things like atrazine, as an example, the most commonly used chemical at that time. Atrazine has significant carcinogenic effects, deficits to the immune system, all of that, or deficits to the ecosystems that had been observed. And so Roundup was put on as the safe alternative to atrazine. And the message that was carried out to the world around this weed killer was that it was safer than water. And so all of the salespeople for this, the agronomists, were taught to tell farmers, this is the new chemical, it's safer than water, which is a weird tagline because it's kind of hard to imagine something that's actually safer than water. Interestingly, that, you know, we talk about scientifically, can water be damaging to biological systems? And at a certain level, it can be. But the idea that we had better nature in her own capacity to support life was kind of an ironic tagline. But it worked, in that farmers were super excited because they were afraid for their own health, their farm field health, their children's health, getting sprayed and everything else. And so we switched over this chemical in 1976, and it began its insidious journey into the matrix of our environment at that point. One of the huge downsides of this organophosphate is that it's water soluble. That's also why it works so well, as it goes through water systems into every part of the plant. And you might remember that the earth is covered 70% by water. Every plant that grows is about 70% by water. Every animal, including human, is 70% water by volume. And so all of life on earth is about 70% water in our matrix. And so to start adding a chemical toxin that actually can be carried by in water systems was probably short-sighted. And it led to, over the decades, this accumulation of this chemical in the environment that led to this phenomenon that you find 75% of the air we breathe and 85% of our rainfall contaminated with this water-soluble toxin. So what is the meaning of that? Is it even a problem? So now we have glyphosate everywhere in the water system. What's the meaning of that to nature? In its original patents, Monsanto revealed its mechanism of action, which is to block an enzyme pathway called the shikimate pathway that produces the critical amino acids that we call the essential amino acids in our food system. All biology relies on protein synthesis for embryology to form in a womb, all the way to our, good health and vitality as we age. We rely on protein structures, and proteins compose structural proteins like tight junctions and gap junctions that we might talk about, but they also are the workforce. They form the enzymes, which are complex proteins that act kind of as these robotic machinery that do detoxification, do neurotransmitter movement of resources. So they're kind of the transportation, distribution, detox, coordination system of the whole body. Those are all complex proteins that we call enzymes. So enzymes, all the way to kind of structural proteins, rely on a very small data set of building blocks called amino acids. And there's 22 amino acids that build over 400,000 proteins that would make a human body possible. Those 22 are interesting in that the 22 amino acids, most of them can be made by every human cell. And so a human cell finds resources and can put an amino acid building block together. And unfortunately, or by nature's design, there's 9 that we cannot make. And so those 9 essential amino acids are termed essential because we have to get them from our environment namely from food or contact with soil systems. And those nine are largely made by bacteria, fungi, and plants that we might consume. And so human cells are not capable of making the essential amino acids. The shikimate pathway that is blocked by Roundup and glyphosate, Roundup is the trade name that got plugged on by Monsanto, but it also came off patent in 2006-07. And so now every weed killer in the world, 95% of them have glyphosate as an active ingredient. And so the initial intent was block the shikimate pathway so that when you spray a plant, it can't make its proteins and therefore it dies very quickly. And so that was the initial mechanism of action of this weed killer as it was initially patented. What was quickly discovered, though, is that these essential amino acids go far beyond killing weeds, and they could be used in other applications or have other kind of biologic effects. When you think about deleting four of the nine essential amino acids, you're talking about eliminating alphabet here, right? And so those 22 letters spell all of the words that would be proteins in the whole body. And if you imagine the English alphabet, 26 letters with those six vowels or whatnot, and you suddenly took away a couple vowels, you start misspelling every word. The essential amino acids are classic for that, in that they're not representing, a third of the total amino acid pool. They're actually representing more like 80% because they are used so often as the vowels are in the alphabet of language or the alphabet of protein synthesis. And so we've deleted four of those critical amino acids from much of the pool of life over these last decades as we have saturated the biology of the planet in this chemical that blocks our ability to build the building blocks for life. So you fast forward a couple of decades of this saturation effect and you start to see the explosion of the chronic disease epidemic that could have never been imagined in 1976. And by 1996, we're starting to see massive epidemics and new phenomena. We had to start naming new diseases: gluten sensitivity, celiac disease, fibromyalgia, polyrheumatic conditions, chronic regional pain syndromes. None of those existed when I started my medical training as a medical doctor in the early 1990s. And so we had this new explosion of new diseases that weren't just like showing up in part of the population. They were affecting vast swaths of industrialized populations across the world. And so that was the 20-year accumulation of organophosphates, the deletion of the building blocks for life, and a disruption of our relationship to nature ultimately.
It's such a crazy dystopian story when you lay it out like that. It's so frustrating. And so I'm familiar with that study in Mississippi. Have they done, which is kind of like the epicenter, right? Because there are these kind of cancer maps. And if you look at, maybe in the YouTube version of this podcast, we'll put a graphic on the screen showing people where glyphosate is used in the United States. But there are these like hot zones. I mean, Mississippi is probably ground zero for glyphosate. Have they studied like air and water in states other than Mississippi? Are we really just, I mean, does someone that lives in Oregon need to worry about this as well? I guess there's a lot of people listening to this that live in the Southeast or the southern part of the U.S. And that map of glyphosate extends all the way up really through Midwest. Most of the U.S. is covered, but is there anywhere that's like free from this stuff? You said it's water soluble. Is it just everywhere now?
Yeah, it's in every part of the ecosystem globally now. You can't escape it. There will be hot spots within that global distribution, but the rainfall is something that obviously distributes globally through the cloud systems and all of that. And so we really do have a full saturation. And sadly, the United States is no longer the hotspot globally for the production and use of these chemicals. Brazil is now number one in the world. So you can imagine the epicenter of the Amazon jungle getting decimated by the highest use in the world now of that. Second behind Brazil is China. And so you can imagine all of Asia being buried in this. And in 2019, at the Sun Valley, Idaho Festival, I was showing the glyphosate spraying in China and overlapping that with the air pollution of China. And I showed and predicted that the next pandemic of a respiratory virus would come out of Wuhan, because all you have to do is overlap glyphosate spraying with pork production with the air pollution, and the hottest spot in the entire world is right in Wuhan province. And so it felt like, 6 months later, I was like reading some sort of eight ball, but it turns out that was just, ridiculously predictable based on the simple biology of how we stress biology. And when biology is stressed, it makes viruses, and viruses require air pollution to travel far. And so it was very predictable that, you know, if we were going to get distribution of a new virus, it was going to have to come out of this perfect storm of agricultural toxicity with industrial pollution overlaying it. And if you look at all of the death maps that came out of our pandemic, you can pinpoint exactly the overlaps of glyphosate exposure with air pollution. And that predicts your mortality rates in, you know, every state, every city within the world. And so.
So the places with the highest air pollution or the most glyphosate had the highest mortality.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're going to see that pattern again and again, repeated. And you asked, are people measuring this? And municipalities are often now measuring this. The federal government in the United States is now, increased our tolerance or our safety threshold for glyphosate in the municipal drinking water of the whole country to 700 parts per billion. Europe is at 0.1 parts per billion. And so it's actually a 7,000 fold increase in what our allowables are in the United States, because we realized as we started testing municipal water systems that we weren't even remotely close to European standards. And so to realize we're 7,000 times higher by a safety threshold is amazing. That's 700 parts per billion. But my laboratory, which has been working on glyphosate toxicity in human cells over the last 10 years, we've been able to show human cell direct toxicity within minutes of exposure at 2 parts per billion. And so 700 parts per billion in our drinking water is nowhere near close if we can show it at 2 parts per billion of the disruption of protein synthesis. And that's the primary thing we can show, is that as soon as glyphosate hits protein environments of humans, we start to lose protein integrity, and we start to get dysfunction. And then unfortunately, the first place that we see that is in the tight junctions. And so the tight junctions are the Velcro that hold human cells together. It's kind of miraculous that you and I are sitting here as 70 trillion cell organisms. Those 70 trillion human cells are held together by this Velcro. And so of all of the organ systems I have, the most complex and largest cooperative, you know, structure that we have is the gut membrane. My gut membrane, when, you know, spread out anatomically, covers 2 tennis courts in surface area. And it's made up of hundreds of billions of tiny microscopic cells that are about half the width of a human hair by circumference there. So you have these near visible but ultimately invisible cells that, you know, through hundreds of billions will make up 2 tennis courts in surface area. And to become that barrier or that healthy boundary from the outside world to your immune system, which sits just beneath that membrane, you have to have tight junctions. And what we've shown again and again in every single organism, not just humans, but everything from mice and rats all the way to cattle and dogs, cats, every animal species we've tested, same phenomenon, that within minutes, the tight junctions fall apart. Within 3 minutes, at these very low exposures, you start to see that leak across the gut membrane. And when you create a permeable surface that no longer has coherent understanding of inside and outside, you start to get this phenomenon of immune activation that ultimately leads to chronic inflammation. And so instead of that acute inflammatory reaction that's life-saving, you start to do so much injury. Every breath you take is now injuring your immune system. Every bite of food you take, every drink of water you take is now going straight through the gut lining right into your immune system instead of being a boundary event. And so that leaky gut is overwhelming the human immune system, such that from 1976 to 1996, over that 20-year period, we had enough accumulation of this chemical within our environment that we developed obesity, which is the first symptom metabolically of glyphosate poisoning, fatty liver, which is the next kind of iteration, fatty liver then leading to prediabetes and diabetes. So that was the first 20-year march of this. And then the next iteration was full-out immune dysfunction. So autoimmune explosion happening in the 1990s and the 2000s. And then if you keep pushing on that same gas pedal of inflammation, you end up with cancer. And so we start to see the cancer explosion happening by the kind of late 2000, 2006, 2010s, when we start to see the hockey stick of lymphomas, leukemias, sarcomas, these cancers that had heretofore been relatively rare and most typically seen in elderly are now being seen in our children and populations we hadn't seen them before in such volume. So that was kind of the slippery slope of protein degradation and metabolic damage within the cells. I should probably just, I'm sorry, I can go on with one question. Technically, it takes me an hour to answer, but there is one other aspect other than the amino acid disruption that we should point out is that Monsanto went on to repatent this thing as an antimicrobial. And so antibiotic, antiparasite, antifungal, it's been patented in all of those spaces because it's recognized that it kills single cell microorganisms throughout the ecosystem. This has really bad implications for farm soil, obviously, because your soil quality relies on complex microbiome, the relationship between fungi, mycelial networks, all that. But now imagine your gut as a soil system, and now drinking and eating an antibiotic on a daily basis, you start to decimate that population. And in the American Gut Project, that's now a multi-university project, but it was spurred by a single individual, a dad who saw his child in 2001 get type 1 diabetes and was told by my medical industry, no, there's nothing to do with food. There's nothing to do with your gut. This is an autoimmune thing. There's nothing you can do. Your kid's going to be on insulin the rest of their life. And with this 1.5-year-old with this sudden autoimmune condition, he just was unhappy with that. So he took his, you know, marketing finance degree and put that all of his 401k into a new research project. And that became the American Gut Project that now has 6 universities involved in this 30-year project. But what they've been able to show is that the healthy immune or the healthy gut microbiome or soil system that we can find in hunter-gatherers in Africa and other people who haven't been exposed to Western food systems, you typically will find 40,000 species of bacteria, let alone maybe another 500,000 fungi and beyond that with protozoa and all that. But 40,000 species of bacteria seems to be like kind of our ideal baseline. You then measure the American gut by 2010 when this project really got underway. And by this time, by 2010, we're showing 8,000 species instead of 40,000. So we'd lost 70 to 80% of our workforce as a soil system, which is responsible for delivering nutrients, delivering water, delivering the vitality of biology, you know, ultimately. And so we simultaneously denuded the soils of the earth and the soils within the guts of humanity. And for that, we see a decrease in our vitality.
After trying many BS supplements, this actually works. Check out this review on beef organs from Heart and Soil Supplements. I'll get right back to the podcast in a moment. So this gentleman says, I'm a night shift cop and my lifestyle is demanding on my body. I've been following Paul and trying to utilize diet to minimize the impact of my lifestyle on my health, as well as alleviate symptoms I already have. I began more animal-based clean living habits, as well as taking beef organs from Heart and Soil Supplements. Here is what I found after 6 months in use. Decreased gut issue, acne has gone away. I wish I could attach photos, but for years I had white horizontal lines going all the way up my nails. Recently learned this could be a sign of nutrition deficiency. My nails are completely clear now. I'm a former college athlete. I've tried many supplements over the years, proteins, greens, various muscle recovery formulas, vitamins. I'm not super in touch with my body, so for me to notice a change, it must be significant. This is the only one of many supplements I've tried where I truly felt a difference. The quality is totally worth it. So I talk a lot about regenerative agriculture in this podcast with Zach, and I'm super proud of the fact that all of our supplements from Heart and Soil are sourced from New Zealand, where they practice regenerative agriculture on the farms that we're using. So this is beyond organic. These are the finest desiccated organ supplements on the market. Do not accept imitators. Chilean, Argentinian desiccated organs are not the same quality. Those are not regenerative farms in Chile and Argentina, which is why we source exclusively from New Zealand and Australia for Heart and Soil. You can find us at heartandsoil.co. We are regenerative. We are small batch. These are desiccated organs. Beef organs contains heart, liver, kidney, spleen, and pancreas. And it's an incredible way to get unique nutrients and organs that are not well represented, muscle, meat, or any really many things on the planet at all in terms of foods. Organs are vital for humans to be optimal. Check us out, heartandsoil.co. Back to the podcast. And this has been measured in humans, right? I mean, there's some statistic that I've heard repeated. I've never seen the study that over 90% of people, maybe 95, 98, what's the number of people have detectable levels of glyphosate in our biology? I mean, probably all of us do, 100%, unless you're...
I think so. I think it's 100%. Yeah. You know, whether or not we can measure that accurately or not is, you know, maybe it's 90% we can measure it in. But we did our own clinical trial in our laboratories and in our clinical population. And what we were doing was showing urine concentrations of glyphosate, you know, pre and post, you know, exposure to fossil soils. So what was the intelligence of soils before all this chemical input? And that's what our biotech company has been doing, is putting fossil soil into supplements to see if we can, you know, reverse the chronic disease epidemic through a reconnect to the intelligence of ancient soil systems. And so we were doing that study, and what we found was we couldn't find a single patient. And these were patients that were largely coming out of our clinical population. So these were people that already knew this information and were trying to eat organic, trying to be as clean as they could, trying to avoid glyphosate. So we picked the healthiest, you know, in some ways, the most privileged people on the planet in regards to their knowledge of and efforts to avoid it. And still 100% of them had glyphosate in their urine. So I don't know that if there's anybody who's been able to stay glyphosate free on the planet. I highly doubt it, just because of the connected biology that we have and the fact that this chemical has been infiltrating our water system for, you know, 45 years now in a big way.
And you mentioned this, but I just want to draw the connection here as well. What happens if you overlay maps of glyphosate use and cancer incidence in the United States?
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, that was kind of my big debut in the medical system. So even before I started my nonprofits, I was lecturing to medical doctors all over the country and ultimately internationally with these maps. And so I was showing that the glyphosate spraying, 80% of the glyphosate spray in the United States is done in what we would call generally the Midwest, kind of running from North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota area, all the way down to the Mississippi and the Gulf of Mexico. And so this huge broad swath covers about 18 different states in the majority of it. But that 18 to 20 states within our 50 spray about, you know, 80% of the glyphosate into our system, because this is where we do most of our large-scale agriculture in the country. And then a couple other hot spots, California being a major one, because it's where most of our produce comes from that ends up on a human food plate, is coming out of just a few counties in Northern California. So you get these hot spots. Washington, Oregon has a hot spot. Northern California has a hot spot. Southern California around San Diego County, hot spot. And then a few others around the country outside the Midwest. But all of that 80% sprayed happens to go into a single river system, which is the Mississippi tributaries. And so they start up near the border of Canada, and they collect that 80% of farm runoff from those environments, and that any water-soluble nutrient, toxin, herbicide, pesticide, whatever it is going to end up in that water body. And the Mississippi ends in the last 90 miles of it in Louisiana, in the Gulf of Mexico there. And Louisiana has the highest cancer rates in the entire developed world now, as it collects that huge swath of glyphosate. And we call that Cancer Alley. So the Cancer Alley runs between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And so the highest rates of cancer in the developed world are sitting right there at our glyphosate, you know, epicenter. And when we looked at the cancer pattern around the country and superposed that, you realize it's not the spraying of the chemical that's mapping our cancer. It's the accumulation of it within water systems, and it's then distribution through air and rain. And so it's the air-rain distribution of that Mississippi River that you can see our cancer hotspot became. And the striking thing that I was showing is that before 1996, our cancer in the United States was always, as far back as we measured it, over 100 years, had always been the Northeast, with one little pocket in the Northwest around prostate cancer. But cancers across the board were always in our hot pocket of the Northeast. We had never seen a cancer epidemic in the deep South of the United States. And this is very important, because a lot of people will justify our current cancer map by being a map of socioeconomic risk. Well, poor people and depressed economies and blah, blah, blah. No. Mississippi, Louisiana were some of our poorest states in 1995, and they are today. And the cancer risk was not there in 1995. And by 2005, they had become the epicenter. So it was not an economic phenomenon. It is fully a toxin phenomenon.
Wow. So United States, Midwest, a couple of pockets, Southern California, Washington, Oregon, Brazil, China. There are some places in Europe where they're sort of getting rid of it, right? Like, I forget.
They haven't gotten rid of it over there yet, but they're making efforts towards it. Right. And so there's hopes that France will be maybe, free of glyphosate by 2025. But every time they set the guard post or the guidepost, they move because the industry comes in and there's special interest push. And the governments are having a really hard time, like, putting down their foot. I believe pretty deeply that the first fully organic country in the world is going to be Russia. They set goals almost 6 years back that they would become a completely organic production system by 2025. And they already, a long time back, were the cleanest production system of grains and other legumes to the world. So much so that by, I think it's 3 to 5 years ago, Germany jumped on board with Japan that had done it previously, was to outlaw the importation of all North American grains. Canada and the United States both practicing these chemical intensive methods for producing corn, soybean, wheat, and the rest. And so grains, grain importation got outlawed in Japan and then subsequently in Germany. And Germany then became their primary export or import locations were from Ukraine and Russia. And so when you see the current sociopolitical, you know, expression of war, it used to just be follow the oil. That was how you mapped, you know, conflicts and where wars would be started. Now you can follow oil and soil and see exactly where the wars are being seeded. And so the Ukraine war sits at the breadbasket of Germany and Europe, and the United States is now buying up through Vanguard and BlackRock most of that growing system there towards the end of the Ukrainian conflict there. And so I really deeply believe that social political conflict is now seeing that economics is not just driven by oil. It is driven by food systems ultimately. And who controls the food system globally is who controls global economics ultimately. And so we're seeing a pivot from oil to soil as the most valuable asset on the planet. And you can see the pivot of big, you know, foundations, the Gates Foundation and things like that, starting to buy up farmland. And so if you want control of the future of humanity, it's going to have to do with food systems. And so if as a humanity, we want to really pivot towards a future that's, you know, sustainable and has freedom involved, we're going to need to start to look at distributed food systems, distributed models of soil relationship for communities to start to, you know, have access to their own soil systems, have access to their own food systems, which seems kind of obvious. But if you look at the United States, for example, our average food supply chain is 3,000 kilometers. So, you know, we stopped growing food in our communities a very long time ago, you know, like 80 years ago. And so we're way down the path of deep dependence on extraction models that are relying on slave labor kind of models where you get super cheap labor in you know, Peru or other parts of South America. And so America is exploiting that. Europe has been exploiting Africa for decades now with their food system. And so we have this colonialism, slave labor kind of model towards food for all of history. You look back thousands of years, the Egyptians were fighting wars to get slave labor to grow their food. So it's not a new phenomenon there. But this ownership of soil now is kind of the insidious overlay to that cheap economy of labor that the food system has been dominated by. So we're at a deep tipping point, not just, you know, so from a biologic standpoint, I think we're finally getting a spiritual reality check here of humanity. If you want to stick around, you're going to have to find your humanity. You're going to have to discover that you are nature and nature speaking through you. And this is your opportunity to become something new. And so as dismal as all of these numbers sound and all of this reality sounds, my silver lining that I wake up every day to and have the gumption to go ahead and put another foot forward and try to get these projects global and everything else is the reality that humanity never changes until we have hit the wall. That's the only thing that the human psyche can respond to encourage and incite total transformation. And we are in a 70,000-year end of a cycle here of humanity's expression over a 300,000-year period. The last 70,000 years of civilization is coming to an end. And we need to re-express our human qualities, our human spirit in this next iteration going forward after this decade. And so in 2030, who are we and how do we show up on the planet? And I'm very excited that we're being taken to our knees at this moment so that we can ask that question from a deep place of self-reflection and a deep space of realization that there is no monetary solution here. There's no technological solution. There's in some ways only our spiritual reconnection that has to happen as we realize ourselves to be indigenous to planet Earth. And if we could remember that indigenous culture within us, I think we have a path forward.
And there are glimmers of hope here. I think that's an amazing like clarion call that you outlined there for people. And we're in kind of a precarious position with regard to our health and the ubiquitous nature of this compound and other compounds as well, and just the quality of our food system. But I've heard you say some things like, I think I heard you say, and tell me if I'm misquoting you or this is a wrong, that like if the organic food movement grows, there is a tipping point at which Monsanto can no longer be supported or Monsanto can't be solvent. I think I heard you say that if if 40% of our food is grown organically, Monsanto kind of collapses. I should say Bayer Monsanto now, because they're now a conglomerate. Just so people know that the pharmaceutical industry and Monsanto are now connected. And if you had any misgivings about the dystopian nature of this predicament. So is that true that if we elevate organic food, or if we can help consumers understand the importance of organic food, there is a point at which we could tip this in the right direction?
Yes, that is true. And the numbers might be debated slightly, but the general structure is actually pretty well known outside of this predicament. We know pretty well from a socioeconomic standpoint, at which point does an industry have to go through transformation or an old system completely fail economically? And that number is actually quite low, around 16% of an industry. So when 16% of an industry hits this new threshold of possibility or expression, the whole follows very quickly. Right now, we're at about 4% in the United States of our agricultural system practicing organic agriculture, but only about 0.1% or so practicing regenerative organic. The difference there is kind of important, that organic agriculture was basically an anti-movement, anti-chemical. And so here's the things that you cannot do. And if you don't do these things, then you're an organic farmer. The downside of an anti-movement, which is our model for general activism, unfortunately, perhaps globally, is it's not showing us the future. It's showing us what we don't want to repeat, but it's not showing us a path to the alternative way of being. And so what happened with the organic industry is we stopped using chemicals, but we started relying on other technologies to do what the chemicals used to do, which is namely to knock down your cover crops or your weeds so that you could have bare soil to plant in. And what we tended to do is start to overplow instead of spray. And in overplowing, we did the same damage. And so if you look, you know, my aha moment came in 2018 when we were filming a documentary from the headwaters of the Mississippi down to New Orleans to tell this story of the maps that I just mentioned and all that. If you want to see that short film, 22 minutes, farmsfootprint.us is the org. And you can see those cancer maps overlaid with the spraying maps and all of that in a 22-minute film there. But in our very first farm that we stopped at, there happened to be a soil education group there, and they were showing the difference between organic and conventional soils and their quality of nutrient density and kind of vitality. And I was devastated to see that the organic soils were actually underperforming compared to conventional chemical agriculture. And so I had set out to tell this film, ask my company to put up all this money to make this film. And then like day three, I'm like, oh my God, we have the wrong premise here. What the heck are we doing? Fortunately, they had in that soil test, about an hour later, a demonstration of regenerative soil and its capacity to overcome the problem. And what I saw was a philosophy that started to go pro-future rather than anti-past. And so organic is a symptom of we're anti-chemicals, but what the heck are we? Are we just more mechanized versions of trying to do the same thing? What happened with regenerative agriculture is a recognition of hundreds of years of indigenous cultures that had practiced soil management instead of crop production. With the focus on the soil instead of the output, it changed the relationship of the farmer or the homeowner to the end product. And this is kind of the healing of the planet now, where instead of measuring how much we're extracting from the planet, we start measuring how much we give to the planet. And when nature is given to, when we start to provide for nature, it's unbelievable the abundance that comes back to us. And so this is kind of this rediscovery of the relationship of humanity and our soil systems, globally, is this regenerative movement. And it's been popularized and really successfully demonstrated in biodynamic farming and other forms of agriculture that date back hundreds of years, and then some more recent ones that have come online, new Korean farming and some of these other aspects of farming. So regenerative agriculture in my world is kind of a bucket that we can throw a bunch of different farming practices in that have been soil centric and have been focused on the relationship of the producer towards producing soil and healthy ecology, rather than just measuring bushels of corn on the backside of that equation. So that was where we pivoted in 2018 to realizing that the movement needed to be regenerative. And since I had been studying this stuff, on the ground for all these years and didn't know the word regenerative agriculture at the time, we realized we were going to need to be part of a network of new organizations that were coming online to popularize the understanding of regenerative agriculture at the global scale and start to become storytellers to those farmers that were already successfully showing this model at scale around the world in almost every ecosystem on the planet, showing the success of soil management rather than crop production as a focus of their efforts and the incredible abundance that was coming out of that, not just from a crop standpoint, but actually from a sociology standpoint, starting to resolve the tragedy of no succession plans for most farms on the ground, because in the current chemical model, there's such small revenue streams that are squeaked out of these things. And you wake up every morning as a farmer to get on your tractor and kill something. You're spraying herbicides, you're spraying pesticides, you're in hazmat gear mixing these chemicals together. When kids see their parents engaged in this activity every day, it's very uninspiring. And then to see the stress of their parents as bankruptcy comes closer and closer, and their parents are trying not to lose the fifth generation farm and all of this, and suicide rates are 5 times higher than any other industry in the world. No wonder the average farmer in the United States is now 70 years old without a succession plan, because the younger generations were told to go elsewhere, go do something else. This is not your future. And we were watching regenerative farmers reverse that pattern where they were so in joy and amazement and spiritual enrichment for their relationship back to the land that their children were being inspired to rejoin that effort and to become part of that. And children today are understanding the opportunity of a distributed economic system. And so when these farms are reimagining themselves as, instead of being commodities, marketplaces to sell into some, you know, black box of corn sales, instead, let's develop a relationship with people that want healthy food on their plants, and let's start growing things that can rebuild this bridge between farmer and eater. And that phenomenon of knowing the person that you're impacting is what resolves the suicide rates, which resolves the succession planning problem and everything else. And these elder farmers that are making this transition in their 50s, 60s, and 70s don't know how to make that distributed leap, but their grandchildren do. Their grandchildren know how to put up a website, how to create a brand, how to do social media, how to do crowdfunding. So it's really cool. We're watching this young generation pivot to their skill sets that they've learned in a technologically distributed vision of where the world is going, and then bringing the farm industry back towards that possibility of a future where we start buying food locally and we start eating seasonally and we start to understand ecosystem roles within the food and vitality that we're consuming in the family. And we start to eat again with the spirit of gratitude rather than this consumptive consumer behavior.
Yeah, I know Will and Jenny Harris from White Oak Pastures were just on Joe Rogan's podcast, which I was happy to see. I think the listeners of my podcast will be somewhat familiar with the term regenerative farming, mostly in the context of animal agriculture and raising cattle that are grass-fed and grass-finished, but beyond grass-feeding and grass-finishing, which is a term that can get muddied and greenwashed, quote-unquote, these days, this regenerative raising of animals for people that want to eat animal meat and organs is such an incredible thing. I mean, White Oak Pastures is situated right in the middle of Georgia, but they're kind of this beacon of hope doing this, and I've been to their farm. You know, they have soil samples, Zach, and they have the neighbor's farm, which is a peanut farm. It's kind of light colored dirt, and they have their farm, which is this dark colored dirt. And then they, you know, test the carbon in the two soils. And so I completely echo what you've seen is that when you have regenerative soil, it's a completely different thing than conventional soil or even organic soil. So I'm so excited about this regenerative movement, but man, it's going to take a while to educate people about the value of this movement. And have you been to Rome Ranch? You've been to Rome Ranch in Texas, right?
Yeah, I sponsored their Earth Day with Farmers Footprint. I think it was 2 years ago we were there and did a big event there. And we were back on Earth Day this year with a smaller part of our team. But yeah, what they've done there to bring back these keystone species is so inspiring. They've brought back the bison to the wilderness of Texas there. And we're now working on this globally with our nonprofit. Project Biome is looking at how we return keystone species to river systems throughout the world to get the reversal of our desertification that's happening globally. How do we re-kickstart the natural generative cycle that the planet goes into every 14,000 years? And so excitingly, we're right at that threshold where the planet is ready to go back into its regreening of North Africa, regreening of Saudi Arabia, regreening of China and South Siberia. One third of the planet is ready to start on this regenerative journey again, But right now we have chemical agriculture kind of as the knee on the neck of the planet, and it can't take that next breath. When we kill 97% of the arable soils on the planet, which we've done over the last 50 years, 97% of farmable land globally is depleted or severely depleted in its ability to respirate carbon. That's why there's CO2 in the atmosphere. And so this whole kind of politicized story of, you know, greenhouse gases and it's because we're burning fossil fuels is actually profoundly inaccurate. In fact, I think very dangerous to our future, because it's it's externalizing the problem to a human behavior when in fact it's a biologic behavior of the planet itself that's leading to the accumulation of gas. And this can be demonstrated very clearly by, you know, the data that came out of the pandemic. In those first 6 months of 2020, we froze transportation on this planet like no time in history. Airline travel to near zero. We had global traffic to your work and everything else go to near zero as everybody's locked down in their homes. China, you know, India, Africa, North America, everybody locked down hard. And yet the travel of CO2 and methane in the atmosphere actually accelerated that year, not slowed down. And so it is simply not the burning of fossil fuels that is driving this pattern of accumulation of greenhouse gases. It's the failure of the breath of the planet itself. The lungs of the planet is the soil system of the planet. And so as we have chemically denuded the lungs of the planet, we can't take that next breath. But the exciting thing to me is when we do take that next breath, when Earth can breathe again, the speed at which we're going to regreen may have never been seen in history of a 4-billion-year planet, because we have more CO2 available to biology than perhaps has ever existed before, because we have mined all of that oil out of the ground over the last 150 years. All that oil being burned through fossil fuels and everything else has actually made the carbon available. Biology can't reach those deep fossil layers of oil, but they can as it's brought to the surface. And so interestingly, for all of the damage we have done to the environment, we may inadvertently have prepared the Earth for the most rapid and extreme greening that this planet has ever done over the next 1,000 years. And I really want young people to hear this. We're not in climate crisis. We're in climate metamorphosis. We are about to see a planet that has never occurred before. And it might take the extinction of humans to achieve that, if we don't change our behavior. Like, we may need to just die out, as we're quickly doing here, because our biology is not independent of the planet. And so as we go extinct, this planet is going to skyrocket into its most explosive biodiversification and beautification it's probably ever done. Every extinction has led to radical biodiversification, which increases the intelligence of species, increases the number of species and the rest. Remember, the last extinction took us from dinosaurs to mammals, to birds, to, you know, humans ultimately. And it took us from palms and ferns as the only flora of the planet to deciduous trees, wildflowers, and the like. So the beauty of this planet today is the result, direct result, of an extinction death of the planet 55 million years ago. And so the imagination of biology accelerates and compounds logarithmically when it's under an extinction level stress. And so when we see this fear of viruses and all of this talk about this, we need to remember that viruses are the expression of stressed nature. And right now we have, as humans being the existential threat on the planet, put the entire biologic system of Earth under its greatest stress in 55 million years. And for that, every species is reimagining what it could look like after the stress resolves. And so it's exciting to know that right now on Earth, and even probably in my bloodstream right now, is all of the genetic possibilities of which could happen after this extinction ends. And the Earth has got more resources to drive biology in the form of carbon than any time in history. And it's important for us to remember, just as we've demonized viruses, which are the genetic potential of the future, we've demonized carbon, which is literally the gas tank in biology on Earth. You cannot have a single leaf on a tree or a single earthworm or a single human without carbon as the fuel for that biological phenomenon to happen. And so we keep demonizing in our politicization of our stories on climate, we keep demonizing the very things that make life possible. And it's this adversarial belief system and adversarial relationship to our nature that really needs to resolve. And it goes all the way down to our deepest definitions. If you look up the Oxford English Dictionary and the word nature, it says that nature defines everything on the planet, including minerals, rocks, you know, leaves, the trees, the animals, everything except humans or anything humans have created. And so somehow in our English language, we decided to write humans and everything we've created right out of nature. And I think that is a symptom of this deep psychological wound that we carry around thinking that we did get rejected from nature. Somehow we got rejected from the garden that's in our myth of so many religions. If we got rejected from nature, then that must mean nature's against us. And so we have had this stance against nature for thousands of years. And the rise and fall of empires is driven out of the scarcity that happens when you don't think you belong to nature, when you don't think you have a mother. When we reaccept nature as our mother, as the source of life itself that made humans possible, and as we accept that nature is literally speaking through our biology to a future event, or at least to this present event, but I think to this future event of what comes after our current iteration of humanity, then we can resolve that fear paradigm. And when we lose the fear and also the guilt and shame, we have to lose the guilt and shame that we're the worst thing that ever happened on the planet, we're the cancer of the planet, we're the existential threat. We need to lose the fear of nature and also the guilt and shame of our relationship to that nature and start to realize that actually, even in our worst mistakes, we prepared nature for her rebirth. The stress that we have induced has prepared her for the new birth that will be this new planet, this new future. And so for that, I think we can start to remind each other that we need to apologize to one another. We need to apologize deeply to our Earth itself, perhaps. And then we need that forgiveness to come through. And what I get to see over the last 15 years in my clinic, as we've started practicing more and more regenerative medicine, where we're really working on the relationship of the individual to itself, to self-source and its ecosystem within, healing happens at an exponential rate compared to the rate of disease. And so patients who have been accumulating disease for 30, 40 years can come in 3 or 4 months, see reversal of those disease processes that took decades to occur. And that's the grace that is really built into the fabric of our biology or perhaps of our entire universe, is that repair and regeneration happens faster than the death, dying, and disease processes do. And so there's a deep promise of what I've witnessed is that everything is going to heal faster than we can possibly imagine. And I want young people to know this because too much of our political rhetoric is that the planet's doomed, humanity's doomed. Well, that's true if we don't change. But with our change in relationship to our nature, the rebirth will be more ecstatic, more beautiful, more exuberant than we can possibly imagine, because we haven't let ourselves believe that nature is part of us and we are part of nature and that we are going to regenerate. We are going to create new life and intelligence that we can't imagine.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you. I think that the planet's going to be fine. I don't know if Homo sapiens are going to be around for a whole lot longer, but maybe that's part of it. You know, we learned. I mean, there's multiple species of humans. I think that even for me, for so many of us, it's so hard to conceptualize the fact that there are these much broader cycles of life on this planet than what we imagine. I mean, this is 2023. That's just the last 2,000 years. There's, like you said, we're talking, you know, 50 million years ago, there were dinosaurs and extinction events. There's potentially this meteoric event 12,800 years ago, the Younger Dryas impact, and there's all of these cycles that are much bigger than what we're doing. And this idea that there's, what, 400 and I don't know how many parts per million carbon right now on the planet. I mean, 450, 460, 480. But there have been times on the planet when there have been 1,000 or 2,500 parts per million of carbon, you know, maybe a billion years ago or hundreds of millions of years ago. So there's all this life and death and these cycles on the planet. This is interesting to think that, like, the planet does this and it could potentially regreen. And this idea, I love this idea of the earth breathing. I never thought about it that way, but I want people to understand that by that, I think what you're referring to is the fact that the earth can inhale this carbon back into the soil. And that's kind of what regenerative agriculture does. It can fix the carbon from the atmosphere, but there's carbon in the atmosphere now that the earth can then inhale in a very big way in the future. And as it inhales it back into the soil, that can become life. And when there's more carbon in the atmosphere, there are more trees and there's more greenery in some ways. I think that the problem we often run into here is that people will conflate carbon in the atmosphere with the particulate pollution that goes along with it. And those are not the same thing at all. I mean, sometimes more carbon in the atmosphere can be good for plants. And the earth can manage this carbon cycle in so many ways. I think that glyphosate in the air, that benzene and organic solvents in the air, these are problematic for humans. But carbon is a much more complex topic than most of our political commentators would have us believe. And I think you're right. I think a lot of rhetoric gets spouted about carbon in the atmosphere and decisions get made that are perhaps misleading. So let's return to like an individual focus for a moment, because I want people to have some actionable tools from your perspective. We spent the first half an hour of this podcast talking about the pervasiveness of glyphosate, the problems at the gap junctions, the epithelium on the inside of the gut, potentially the epithelium, these you know, tight junctions at every membrane of our body, whether it's our lung alveoli, whether it's the inside of our blood vessels or the blood-brain barrier. We talked a little bit about this organic produce or the organic foods, the quality of your food, but like, what else can humans do? So if someone's listening to this and they're going, oh my God, there's glyphosate everywhere, what steps do you take in your life? What do we do here, Zach, from your perspective, yeah, to live in this world where we've got glyphosate everywhere? I mean, I guess people could look on a map and say, where's the lowest glyphosate in the world? I'm moving to Iceland. I don't even know if it's low there. I'm just guessing, but what do we do?
Yeah. Yeah. The journey has been interesting. When we first started in 2018, you know, we were going to be prescriptive. Stop doing this and go do this, you know, and even when by 2020, when we launched, you know, a lot of our programming around Farmer's Footprint and all of this, we really had this belief that if we told people enough information that they should go do this instead, then we would all be okay. And what slowly happened is that my clinical world of medicine started to merge with this farming, you know, kind of food systems experience, in that over a 25-year history as a medical doctor, I started to realize that there is no extrinsic thing that I can give a patient. Drugs were my first training. I spent 17 years in academic medicine. I was a chemotherapy development, you know, guy at the University of Virginia developing the next generation of chemotherapy. So I was pharmaceutical all the way. Like, I was developing the future of pharmaceutical industry. I was so passionate about it. I was just convinced we were going to solve everything. And in that journey, it was actually my patients that started to show me that no matter how good my chemotherapy got, I was never going to stop this huge deluge of cancer that was starting to emerge from the population. And it was one of my patients that was in my very first clinical trial with this new drug that I had developed, that she was literally the first one, 6 capsules in her hand, and I'm trying to convince her to swallow these new capsules, this new drug. And she finally, you know, in her deep intuition says, what do these 6 capsules have to do with the reason I got cancer? And suddenly 17 years of education came screaming to a brick wall, you know, collision. And I suddenly realized that absolutely nothing in those capsules had anything to do with why she got cancer over the last decades. And that was a devastating moment psychologically for me. I drove home that night. I drove to the hospital that night thinking, I was in elation. I was like, admitting my first patient of the first clinical trial with this new drug, and I was going to be famous, and this was going to be so good, breakthrough for people needing this drug all over the world. And I left in the deepest sense of despair because I had so radically missed the target, which was similar to that moment of everybody needs organic, and then you find out organic soil can be worse than the conventional thing, and you crash again. Like, so my life has been kind of these deconstructions by mode of brute force collision with brick walls of reality that have helped me back to this realization that there is no prescription for the future. There's no prescription of how you should eat, where you should live, how you should do this. Instead, there is an experience of connection. And so that happens at the individual level. And so now we've pivoted from, you know, we got to do all this stuff and farming and to we need to start meeting one-on-one in groups of human beings and start to have an experiential experience, maybe in an intimate one-on-one experience, but maybe in small groups and ultimately at community levels, of this transformation that happens inside of us when we remember we are from here. We are actually of this earth. We are of this soil. We are of this nature that is speaking through us. And so your individual journey has to begin at that deep question of, did I get kicked out of nature, or am I, have I always been in this nature? That has to resolve within you if you expect your future lifestyle to actually match the value system and biologic reality of the nature you live within. Because if you don't solve that deep wound of rejection, and then you're not going to solve the scarcity mentality that drives us towards this extraction and competitiveness and kind of destruction colonialism model of human expression. You could go fix the way you go buy food at the farmer's market instead of the grocery store or something like this, but you're still going to be consuming at a rate that's destroying the planet in different ways. And so it's really this deep reevaluation of who am I and where do I hail from? What do I have to express here? Why did I come here at this moment? It's kind of unique. Humans have been around 300,000 years, and yet you picked this decade to be in the state that you'd even be listening to this podcast. Why are you here listening to this podcast? You must be in some sort of deep relationship back to nature that's calling you to be part of this transition of humanity into our new expression. You would not be listening to this. This would not have come into your consciousness had you not been part of the solution. And so I deeply believe that on a quantum physics level, there is no particle in the universe out of place. There is no mistake happening within the cosmos right now. Instead, nature is iterating, expressing, and showing more and more beauty, intelligence, and therefore more capacity to see that beauty and therefore vibrate in this vibration that we might call love. This is why we are here, is to experience integrated nature within us, to witness nature without, outside of us and within us, and start to see each other in the context of this beauty and start to treat each other radically different. These wars that are burning in our media right now are the last mirror we need. Do we really need cycles that can cycle every 5 or 10 years showing us the conflict of humans that is so severe that we would think it reasonable to behead each other's children, burn each other in the streets, bombing our cities into oblivion? How many more mirrors are we going to need to show us that it's our macro behavior reflecting this micro belief of rejection that is the revolving door of the annihilation of humans against humans, humans against our planet, humans against the very nature that we're built from? How many more mirrors are we going to need before we hit that wall? And so I hope that today is like one of those walls that just stops you in your tracks and makes you realize I need to reevaluate absolutely everything. My job, my relationships to family, my relationships to my land, my relationships to self. I need to reevaluate all of that. And it's going to have to begin in this internal journey into who are you, where do you come from, and what are you here to express? And that's going to take a lot of listening rather than doing. This is the opportunity where we realize, wow, we went down a long avenue, 70,000-year epoch wrapping up. The current estimates is that we have about 60 harvests left on the planet with our current treatment of soils globally. 60 harvests left. There's no technological, lab-grown meat that's going to get us out of this situation. This is the destruction of nutrients on the planet, not just, fresh food. This is the destruction of, at the base of the vitality of the microbiome, we have 60 harvests left. If you look at human fertility and the collapse of it, the sperm counts in all Western countries globally, all industrialized countries have dropped by 52 to 62% over the last 40 years. 1 in 3 males is now infertile in our industrialized world. The only place in the world that we see sperm counts starting to slowly recover from previous baselines is Africa. And so I believe that's on purpose too, because I mentioned that the regreening of this planet occurs and it happens in Africa. It turns out that the birth canal of this planet from a microbiology standpoint to a macro ecology standpoint is in Africa. That birth canal starts at the tip of Africa where it touches the Ethiopian Ocean, which basically extends down to the Antarctica from the tip of Africa. That big triangular ocean seems to be the womb of all of the biologic mix of viruses and new genetic potential. And so something about that ocean and the energy that it has with the energetics of the planet functions as a womb. And where it touches land near the southeastern tip of South Africa, we see the birth canal of life. And so the microbes move from ocean to land. And we saw the first life there in a place that's called the Cradle of Life. And then about 330 kilometers from there, the Cradle of Humanity. And so we can see these original, emergences of life all the way from the first bacteria 3 billion years ago to humanity just 300,000 years ago. And so these billions of years of birth of life out of this birth canal of Africa seeded everything up into the world. And so if you follow that line up, it's actually a single longitudinal energy line on the planet that runs from that tip of life all the way up through Egypt, and the three pyramids of Giza are right on that line. Run that up to Scandinavia and you've got Stonehenge and all the original things. And so the original peoples that predated our current history knew that this was the energetic birthplace of life on planet, and we needed to tune the planet and maybe the cosmos through this energetic line to continue to consolidate energy and new potential for life. And so we've been dancing on this meridian for hundreds of thousands of years of human history, and we're starting to rediscover this meridian scientifically, emotionally, and spiritually. We're all coming back to our indigenous birthplace. Every single human is African, period. We all came from this one place, and then there was a diaspora about 100,000 years into our history where we started to learn how to do transportation, distribution, we started moving continents and all of this, but that was 100,000 years where we were all there, and then the genetics started to distribute through the planet, and so we are all iterative versions of African blood, African homeland, and if you've never been to Africa, I strongly encourage you to go see at least a sunset in Africa. That was a big reset in my life. The first sunset I saw in Africa was my first cellular awakening that I am from planet Earth. I have a deep cellular remembrance all the way back to the beginning of my humanity that is ignited by the colors and distribution of patterns that happen uniquely in those African sunsets. So go back to our origin place if you get the opportunity, Botswana, Zimbabwe, South Africa. Go back into some of these, the Ethiopian Rift Valley. If you get the chance to go back into these places, I guarantee you will, something will be ignited in you that will be irrepressible because you're here right now at the rebirth of humanity. And I think for us to really truly rebirth, we're going to have to come to a remembrance of where we have been, a forgiveness of our path, and a rebirth through grace, where we leave behind fear, guilt, shame paradigms in our relationship to nature so that we can re-express humanity before we go extinct. With one third of our population already infertile by sperm count, we have about 60 to 80 years left of human species reproduction capacity. And again, in vitro fertilization is just a band-aid at the end of the hospice journey of our species. The proteins and structures within those sperm are being degraded elementally. And so right now, you can maybe get pregnant if you stick it in a test tube. But in the next two decades, with continued accumulation of the epigenetic downstream, there's no sperm on the planet that has the capacity for that rebirth event to happen. And so I'm as horrible as those numbers are, 60 harvests left, 80 years of human fertility left. We are on our hospice moment because we should be, because we have created this opportunity for ourselves. We have created the opportunity to completely transform as the only method of survival. There is no linear path towards recovery because we carry too much epigenetic and genetic trauma from the generations before us that have been living out this divorce from our nature.
Yeah, wow. I mean, I went to Tanzania a few years ago and got to spend time there with the Hadza and to see part of that East African Rift Valley and kind of that really some of the original footprints, some of the oldest fossilized archaeologic, anthropologic remains of humans, the footprints, it's pretty close to the discovery of the Lucy skeleton and the Lucy fossils in Tanzania. So it was really cool. And it definitely stirred some things within me. It was pretty interesting staying at the edge of that sort of cliff and looking out across the national park. You could see elephants down there and giraffes. It was a different world. It was really Lion King-esque was my moment there. But it is true. There's something about that region of the world. And I was there interested in their life as the Hadza hunter-gatherers, but it's truly an incredible place, and I think people should go visit it. Man, thank you so much for the conversations. We've mentioned this a few times, but I want to make sure that people understand this nonprofit you've created, the Farmer's Footprint. So tell us about this as we wrap up and where people can explore it. You mentioned a little bit about this documentary that's there, but this is sort of, it seems like this is a really amazing thing that you've done as a nonprofit at this stage in your life to try and support these movements that you believe in so deeply.
FarmersFootprint.us is the website there for the original organization here in the U.S., but it has now seeded itself around the world. So if you're in Europe, you can go to FarmersFootprint.uk, which is kind of our hub for the European and UK marketplace. And so that experience that you can get there in Farmers Footprint is reconnecting communities to their food systems, reconnecting communities to our relationship with the world that we live in. And so FarmersFootprint.us is your kind of hub there. FarmersFootprint.org.au is our Australia arm, an incredible team down there. I just spent a couple of weeks down there with them with mind-blowing results. The speed at which the regenerative revolution is happening in Australia is so exciting. FarmersFootprint.nz, our new New Zealand team, is just coming online. So if you happen to be hailing from that part of the world, please dial into that new team. They could really use your support and activation right now as part of their new community there. And then projectbiome.org is our global project for reinitiating this birth canal of the planet and kind of reconsidering the possibility that this is metamorphosis rather than crisis when it comes to climate and human health. So projectbiome.org can be there. If you want a bunch more education and a bunch of other stuff around the human health side of everything we've talked about, then all that education is free on my website, zachbushmd.com. Can get you there. The knowledge page has many dozens of hours of content there, long form discussions around what is a virus, what is soil, what is nutrients, what is disease. All these big topics are tackled both in kind of me delivering information as well as some amazing expert panels that are represented in the Global Health Education Summits there that are publicly available there. So a lot of ways for you guys to engage with everything we do. If you want to take a deep dive into the power of fossil soil to reinvigorate humanity by looking at how this repairs and regenerates the human gut, the human immune system, and beyond, the website is www.intelligenceofnature.com. So lots of access points for you.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your work, man. It's so great to connect with you.
Wonderful to be with you, Paul. Thank you for the whole community there. And leave you with one final thing that I just think is irrepressible, and it just came to my mind. When everything I mentioned is kind of your activation of finding self, I want to give you this one thing as a parent, perhaps, or somebody managing a household. Terrifying to find out that your food and water is all carrying this chemical. But a study that recently came out from the University of Ohio was studying the impact of herbicides and pesticides on rabbits and trying to find where are these thresholds of safety. And one of the most toxic cohorts, one of the groups of rabbits that were exposed to the highest levels of pesticides and herbicides, had this inexplicable survival rate. They just seemed to be bulletproof to these chemicals. And at the end of this trial, they just could not figure out what's confounding. Where I finally went and talked to the technician that was actually feeding these rabbits. And it turned out that this individual was so in love with rabbits that before feeding them, he would spend 5 or 10 minutes with each rabbit, stroking them, telling them how beautiful they are, how much they loved them, and just programming them his love and witness of who they are. And they were transmuting the toxins to a point where there was no biologic consequence. And so this is where I think we can begin the new revolution, is love each other so deeply that when we serve each other food, there is no negative impact in our biology because the love and the joy that it is served with and is baked into that food can overcome the toxicity of our cumulative human journey. So love each other into the future and love the food that you serve one another. And I think we start this process of healing.
That sounds amazing. That's incredible. What a great message. Thank you, my friend.
Take care, Paul.